This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. How's everyone doing? Great. Thank you for joining us. And my name is Lena Kim, and I would like to welcome you to the 2015 UCSB Grid Talk Series. This series is sponsored by the UCSB Office of Summer Sessions in conjunction with the Alumni Association and the Carsey Wolf Center. So I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our first speaker in our series. Dr. Gretchen Hoffman is a marine biologist, an Aldo Leopold Fellow, and a professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at UCSB. Dr. Hoffman's research focuses on the responses of marine species to future ocean change, such as ocean acidification and ocean warming, by working in places as diverse as the coastal oceans of California and Antarctic waters. So Dr. Hoffman is committed to communicating her science to broad audiences such as this one, and sharing her research results with groups that make decisions about ocean change in California. So in support of this philosophy of knowledge to action, she is a member of California's Ocean Protection Council's recently formed Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. She has served as a United States delegate to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Workshop on Ocean Acidification in Okinawa, Japan. Dr. Hoffman contributed to the National Research Council's recent report and recommendations on ocean acidification policy and is a lead author on Chapter 24 titled Oceans and Marine Resources in the Third National Climate Assessment. She is a very busy individual, and we are so lucky and fortunate to have her here tonight. So please help me welcome to the stage Dr. Gretchen Hoffman.
Thanks, Lena. Hi, everybody. I can barely see you. How are you? Who'd rather be on a beach right now? I can't raise my hand, right? It's a beautiful day out. I'm really happy to be here. I am a marine biologist, but in the arc of my career, I've started thinking about how organisms and ecosystems that are important to us are going to respond to a changing ocean. And when I say important to us, I mean things that are ecologically significant, that maintain and keep healthy ecosystems around us, but I also mean things that we call natural capital, or a crazy term called ecosystem resources, things we get from the ocean. So what I wanted to do for you guys today, because I know many of you are here doing research projects and you're kind of getting a feel for that university research life, and I wanted to actually treat you like a scientific audience so that I just don't come in here and deliver a few platitudes about this, that, and the other, but I wanted to present to you a lecture that contains data that talks about the big picture, and then we drill down into thinking about something really specific, and we come back up and talk about why this all matters, okay? So welcome to the University of California at Santa Barbara and my lecture. So what we're going to do today is do this in four parts, okay? The first part, I'm going to talk just generally about what is global change biology, because it's kind of a new field of science that's emerging, and a lot of biologists of different stripes are coming to the table to work on this question of what happens to organisms when their environment starts to change, yeah? Then I'm going to talk about a special situation in ocean change biology, now we call it, ocean acidification. And that's where the chemistry in the ocean is changing, and it affects the biology that's in the water. So we're going to talk about that as an introductory kind of way of thinking about it. Then I'm going to tell you what are we learning. And here I'm going to show you a research project that was done here at UCSB, and that specifically tells us something about the California coast. And that's where you might have to pull your hat down, because here comes the data. But I know you guys are all ready for it, right? Because you've been working in labs. Then at the end, I'm going to talk about what are we going to do? You know, what's this balancing act that we have to do to manage a changing ocean and the organisms that we care about and also eat, right? So at the end, the very last slides, you'll see beautiful pictures of maybe kelp forests or eelgrass beds that are underwater. And when you get to those pictures, you'll know, phew, it's almost over, right? Okay, so it's always good to tell people when you're near the end, right? So when you're in here in the afternoon. So let's start at the beginning. Global change biology, what the heck is it? Well, scientists have always studied nature, observations in nature. We look at something and we see where it lives and we think about what features of the environment set its distribution limits. You know, where does it live and why does it live there and what's it doing there? And over the last several decades, people have noticed, you know, that in fact, The physical environment is changing. Climate change, the oceans are warming a little bit, the earth is warming. And part of what's happened is biologists have gotten into this new sort of predictive science, trying to understand what's going to happen to ecosystems and organisms that we care about. And this evolved into what we call global change biology, and there's a scientific journal that addresses that entire topic. You can go look at papers in it. So in this field, people are trying to make predictions about what's going to happen. We might think about vulnerability of a species. We might also think about ecosystem level changes. You know, how much is something going to change if the water warms by a couple degrees? And so that's kind of what people are doing. And you should know that this is a science that also gives information to politicians and policymakers. So if science is about discovery, right, being a politician is about decision making. And even though we kind of make fun of politicians and whatnot, they've got a really hard job right now, right? Because there are some really difficult decisions that need to be made about the environment. So scientists like myself, I've kind of come out of I only work on, you know, problems that aren't very big, but now I want to work on projects that contribute to what policymakers could do with the knowledge that we give them, right? So while we do this, global change biologists, if you ask one, they'll say, well, in general, when the environment starts to change, and we've been studying this now for several decades on the planet, there are four different responses that you can see a group of organisms or a population make or species. So the first one is a geographic range shift. That means you're living in one place, maybe it starts to warm, and the range shift moves. So you just move. You get out of there, you go someplace else where you can live, survive, and reproduce. Okay? The other one is acclimation. No movement is needed, but the organisms are able to use their physiology to adjust to the new conditions and stay in place, so no shifting, right? The next one is adaptation, and this is exactly what it sounds like. Microevolution, changing your genes in order to change the way an organism functions to withstand the changes around them. This one is sometimes called evolutionary rescue. It's a really big area of study right now, so that's one of the biggest probably emerging things that people are beginning to study. And the last one is extinction. No global change biologist loves to study extinction. This is something that we always root for populations to avoid, right? But this is something that we acknowledge is happening, and really it's the three above that organisms use to prevent the fourth. Move, adjust, adapt, or die is what people say sometimes, right? So that's kind of the big picture. But if we kind of like step back a little bit, what people are seeing on the planet when we think about these movements is one of the most predominant responses we see on the planet are shifts in a poleward direction, right? So things in the northern hemisphere shifting north. And this is happening sometimes in hundreds of kilometers at a time, or in the southern hemisphere going south. And even in mountains, in mountain ranges, altitudinal shifts where organisms are going up in elevation to kind of follow the temperatures that they're used to, this migration to stay in a pocket of good temperatures. And in global change biology right now, people are looking at all these different studies that we've accumulated because ecologists do study abundance and distribution, where organisms live and how many of there are there. And here's just a paper that came out in 2010 that shows that if this person could look at data sets for 129 species, they found that about 75% of them, three quarters, are indeed shifting their distributions. So we know that organisms are responding to environmental change in the oceans. We know this is happening. And one of the things that is hard in this field is that you get a little bit of eco-fatigue, or you get bummed out, and you're just like, oh, I cannot deal with this anymore. Why are we even talking about this? Well, we're talking about this because there's a more difficult question, but there's a question that's really hopeful, and that is that evolution works, and it's likely that species can adapt to some of these coming changes. So one of our biggest research challenges right now is to use the tools we have as biologists, population biologists and evolutionary biologists, physiologists and oceanographers to come together and ask these questions of, can species adapt to future change? Can they stay in place and survive? Can they adapt to these conditions? So this is kind of where I'm going to take you eventually as we get to the data set, because that's kind of the coolest emerging stuff we have. But let's do this by talking about a case study. This is often how I do this when I teach at the university. We choose a one animal or one ecosystem. We talk about it, read some papers. So I'm going to give you a case study now talking about ocean acidification. Is anybody in here, other than the people from my lab, have you heard of this before? Do you know what this is a little bit? Yeah, cool. So a lot of people call this the other CO2 problem, right? What is it? Well, carbon dioxide is an atmospheric gas, and in the atmosphere, gases just exchange naturally with the surface of water. In this case, we're talking about the ocean. And of course, the carbon dioxide is increasing in the atmosphere because of our use of fossil fuels. And over time, the ocean has absorbed a whole bunch of carbon dioxide that we've released through our activities on the planet. And the estimates are that, you know, as that CO2 dissolves into the ocean, it creates an acid, and it lowers the pH of the ocean, and it does so pretty significantly, right? So we know this has been ongoing. And if you're in a chemistry lab or you know chemistry, this is just like a little cartoon that shows what's going on. But what happens is CO2 dissolves into the water, here on the left, and it combines with water in a hydrolysis reaction, forming carbonic acid, which then dissociates, and you get that proton. The increased concentration of proton in the water, that's the thing that's lowering the pH of the water, right? And then there's this other crazy thing that goes on where there's a carbonate ion that kind of gets scavenged to bicarb in a way. And that carbonate ion, that kind of greeny chartreuse one, that is a really important molecule in seawater, right? That is a building block for the shells of all sorts of things that make calcium carbonate skeletons, or shells like mussels and oysters and larval forms of invertebrates. So that's the chemistry here, that CO2 dissolves into the water and it drives a change in the pH that's actually bad for the biology. Now, this isn't a surprise, right? So this is just physics. We've known that, atmospheric chemists have known that CO2 dissolves into the ocean. And for a while, before you guys were born, oceanographers would say, hey man, the ocean's absorbing our pollution. And so here we all are in the science boat going, yay, this is great. And in fact, it may be that the ocean has absorbed about 30% of the carbon dioxide we've released in the last little while, right? So several decades. That's great. But then some biologists stood up and said, you know, when that happens, the pH of the ocean changes, and so too does the ability of things to make their hard parts. And so the science boat goes, oh, bummed out, right? So this is super bad news, because what happens is that acid, that change in the pH, is deleterious for what we call calcifying organisms. And once we started to realize this in about, let's say, 1999 to 2000, people began doing study after study after study to try to understand how low pH, that is the ocean acidification component, would influence organisms in the lab. And so people started raising corals and invertebrates, us too, and all sorts of studies were done. And there's a thing called a meta-analysis, where a friend of mine named Christy Croker, she went in and read all the papers and gathered all the data. And what Christy was able to show was that this figure shows the little pictures of all the animals at the bottom, and that dashed line is kind of no change in calcification, but anything below the line is bad news, right? So that's negative response. And so calcification is really negatively impacted, as is growth. So we'll just walk through these. So these are all the studies that Christy put together. And one of the more interesting things that we found is if adult organisms are deleteriously impacted, early life history stages, so the babies, the larvae of a lot of things like mollusk and oysters, are negatively impacted, right? So that was about 5 or 6 years ago, and people had done all this research, and it was really obvious in the laboratory that, wow, when we do these experiments and we expose animals to these conditions, the news is the news is bad. The organisms don't operate well. And what we wanted to do was to go forward and build a strategy of, you know, how do we actually ask, do they have the potential to adapt? How does a scientist do this? And it's a whole community of people trying to address these questions with things that we already have. So techniques we already know. And some of you are probably using them in your laboratory right now. So it's the recruitment of all our knowledge within biology and population on biology and genomics, bringing it to the table to address this question. So what are we learning? Well, Again, another summary. People started saying, hey, you know, all right, fine. So making a shell at low pH is bad. That is hard to do. Physiologically, it's deleterious to the processes that this calcifying organism has. But certainly, there are some things that can tolerate it. So people started asking, well, there are different strains of these things called coccolithophores, these little tiny planktonic organisms. And they seem, some strains seem to be better at doing this. So there might be a genetic component, right? And then a woman named Laura Parker started looking at population differences. And she said, hey, you know, maybe wild oysters are somehow adapted differently than strains that are raised in aquaculture. And she showed a genetic component to how organisms could resist those deleterious impacts of low pH, right? And there are even some organisms that are clonal. And so people have been asking, hey, are different clones, do they have different genetics? So the motif here is that there's a genetic component to how organisms respond to their environment. And the idea that people are gathering around is evolutionary rescue possible? And how do we study those genetics? Well, it's hard when you want to do something like that. You could raise a whole set of genotypes and like a plant experiment and expose them to different things in a common garden experiment. It's very difficult. But we decided to approach this in a really old-fashioned, tricky kind of way, where you let Mother Nature do the experiment for you, right? And ecologists have been doing this forever because people observe nature and they know that there are gradients in the environment. Some places are hotter, some places are not. And there's this process called local adaptation, right? And so I wrote the definition up here so I get it right. It's the fine-tuning of populations to their local environment. And this is done via natural selection. So there's a genetic component. And basically, it means that across a gradient, there'll be some organisms over here that have a different genotype, and they're fine-tuned to the conditions here. And there's some organisms over here, right, in a hotter part of these crazy lights, right, that are even adapted to hotter conditions over here. And that those two genotypes are separated. They've been created by selection. And they're differentially better. They're fine-tuned to their environment. So we wanted to take advantage of this and go out and look at our local ocean here in the California coast and to ask, hey, you know, can we find gradients of pH in the environment? And can we then ask if those organisms across that gradient are not genetically different? Can we not use principles of local adaptation to address this? And, you know, we were also interested in this because as part of the hope component that every organism in the ocean isn't going to flail and die and not reproduce as the environment changes, some of these genotypes out there in the ocean, genotypes of animals, are already adapted to some of these conditions. We kind of know that. And so it may be that the places that are crazy hot or crazy variability or crazy low pH, maybe those are the places that are harboring the genotypes of the future, the ones that can tolerate future change. So there was a lot of reasons to go out there and do this, right? So here we go into our little data section. Ready? So take a deep breath. Ah, there we go. Okay, good. So we're going to talk about a local marine invertebrate, the purple sea urchin. Some of you, if anybody working with Kathy Foltz or anybody in some of the developmental labs, you might be working on these. There are really common benthic marine invertebrate here, and they're found up and down the coast, all the way from Baja, Mexico, up to Alaska. But they were perfect for our studies because they're easy to collect, their distribution spans the places we wanted to study, and they build a calcium carbonate shell. The adults do and the babies do, the early stages do, right? So we wanted to use these guys as our study system and look for that local adaptation component. Now, here comes the crazy part. And if I have a message in my talk that global change biology is this really interesting and charismatic field where you can apply your skills to help understand our changing planet, the second message I have is things are getting really interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary. So I'm a biologist, but I had to collaborate and work closely with oceanographers to get the kind of data I needed. So when you guys are having your research experiences, it's really good to keep your head up and keep your eyes open, to just not decide, oh, I'm just going to work in this little stovepiped area, but to say, hey, that person over there is doing something interesting, and I'm going to go over there and kind of see what they're doing, because it expands your horizons, and if you learn to collaborate, you build linkages, it improves your own work, no matter what you're doing, okay? So what we did was we worked with oceanographers as a team, and we went out and we put out sensors in the water, things that can collect continuous pH data, and basically what we found is that there's a lot of exposure to low pH water up in Oregon, where it says Fogarty Creek and Strawberry Hill, and in Central California at Van Dam State Park and Bodega Marina, Marine Reserve there in the center, Northern California. And then down by us in the light blue Lompoc, we don't get as much low pH water. And this is related to oceanographic stuff where wind blows over the water and this deep, cold, CO2-rich water comes up to the surface and comes to the shore. And this has been going on for millions of years, so that here's Mother Nature's experiment. In California, we have things in Santa Barbara that aren't as used to low pH, and in Northern California, up by Bodega Bay, they are. And we've measured it, and we know it's the case. So there's our gradient. Not much exposure versus a lot of exposure. And our hypothesis is that they're genetically different, and we want to go look, right? So here's what we did. Here's the experiment. This is probably the silliest thing we ever decided to do because it was so much work, but it was done by some really cool people who accomplished this. So what we did is we took the adult urchins and we spawned them out, took their gametes and made embryos and raised them at different pHs to see how things would go, how they would develop. And the little guys, the embryos, the gastrula, and a forearm pluteus are shown here, are like little biorecorders, little bioassays, because they're out in the plankton, and they're making their hard parts in the face of all this chemistry around them in their local water, right around their bodies. And they make a calcium carbonate skeleton that is, when their gastrula is teeny tiny, it's called a triradite spicule, just tiny little grain of mineral, calcium carbonate. And then as they develop, they grow these feeding arms, and they start to look like, I was thinking of a backpacking tent, you know, where you've got the tent poles. That's this carbonate skeleton, and then the tissues, the fabric tent draped over those poles. And those are feeding arms, and its tummy's right in the middle, and they're out there feeding and swimming around and growing their body as they're doing it in whatever situation, whatever chemistry's around them. And so what we wanted to know was, is there a genetic component to this? So there was a professor-like person, a postdoc, we call them, in my lab who did this experiment with us. And what we did is, it's called a North Carolina 2. This is a breeding design that kind of came out of actually agricultural practices where people would want to do crosses to see if there was a genetic component to something. And what we do is you take 8 males per site, so 8 males from Bodega and 8 males from Santa Barbara, and you cross them with 15 females from every site. So this is just a big breeding experiment where you end up with 64 crosses, okay? So it gets scarier. This is the part of science that's scary, right? So then we raise all those crosses at each of them at 2 different conditions. One at a low carbon dioxide concentration that's like low, just a regular pH. So the higher the CO2, the lower the pH. It's opposite. And then we raise them again at a high PCO2, which is really acidic. And then we ask, how are you doing? Right? How are these different crosses responding to these 2 conditions, different CO2 conditions that correspond to different pHs? And this was done by these 2 scientists, Morgan Kelly and Jackie Padilla-Gamino, and they look crazy right now. Their secret code name was Bomba, which stood for something like buckets and ocean acidification and whatnot. But these guys were amazing. They worked from December 15th to about April, end of April, working constantly in the laboratory, doing crosses, doing this every day. And I think this is when I caught them one night at midnight, and they were just kind of falling apart working in the lab. But what they found was really interesting. And for them, it was a very important foundation for their career, because these 2 ladies are now both professors at universities. And so they started out just where you were, kind of went through their science, and eventually did some really neat studies that resulted in them having a career out of doing this. So what these 2 did was in the laboratory, after raising all those larvae, they would measure their body length of the larvae. They would put them under a microscope and measure the length of their body. And that body size is proxy for how much skeleton they made. And if you just took all the data and you scraped it together, the things that we learned was that when they were raised at high CO2 or low pH, they shrunk by about 10%. So the idea is that maybe making a calcified skeleton is energetically difficult at those low pHs. There's not as much carbonate material around, building blocks to make it. So one would plot it like that and you'd go, yeah, shrinking. But if you're a population biologist and you look at it as a function of the sires, the fathers, and look at the families, we call them, what you see is that, just look at the variation, there's a bunch of difference, right? So there's some of them that change size, that shrink, there's some of them that don't change, and there's some of them that actually get bigger. So right away, to kind of cut to the chase here, we were able to do an analysis that said, hey, there are organisms out there that have genotypes that can confer to their offspring resistance to these ocean acidification climate-driven problems. And to get right to the end of the story, what happens is it's really the sires from Northern California. It matters who your daddy is what I always like to say. That if the sire was conditioned in those frequent upwelling and low pH conditions in the north, the progeny from those males was better at dealing with ocean acidification. So that seems really simple, but it was a really, really important observation because it also is a trait that's heritable. And if one is going to propagate a trait through a population, it has to be heritable for it to be a solution. And so that was about 4 or 5 years ago, and we're really getting a great understanding that genetics does play a role in organisms responding to a changing environment. And now you can go into the literature and find studies of people really drilling down and looking at polymorphisms in genes and trying to figure out what populations might be better at responding to climate change. And the reason this is important is because this kind of information allows us to make decisions about what to protect and how to protect it, right? So I'm going to use that idea to bridge to what I call the OA balancing act, where we have to do all these things at once, and we have to do it really well because we don't have a lot of time, okay? So the key issues for research in this area of marine sciences right now, the things that investigators are moving towards and doing, is that we need to do a lot more of this, looking at genetics and looking at local adaptation and trying to find those populations that hold genotypes that are tougher in response to temperature, that are tougher in response to low pH. People in coral biology research are doing this right now. Can we find genotypes of corals and tropical reefs that deal better with bleaching so that there's a chance that the coral reefs will persist in the face of ocean warming? And the answer is starting to be yes, because we're beginning to look. And then what we have to do then in the OA world is we have to measure what's going on in the water so that sensor technology activity has to continue. And then we have to give our information and our insight as scientists to the people that make decisions to protect these ecosystems or to make these what we call management decisions, right? So this is a place where the whole discussion kind of expands. And for me, it always becomes, part of it is, what am I going to do with my degree in marine biology? Where am I going to go when I have this degree? And the truth of the matter is, there are a lot of things we call agencies out there, so like California Fish and Game, NOAA, the National Oceanic Administration, Atmospheric Administration, people who do a lot of marine sciences but work for the government or work for other entities in the state that are interested in these issues. So here's a place where as a biologist, you can really plug in because the science matters to the decision making. Okay? So let's connect those dots across this idea, like the key things that we're going to do in this program. So first, let's start in the environment. If we're going to look for local adaptation and we want to understand some of these things about where pH is really variable and where it's not, we need to be out in the water recording pH and getting physical information about these abiotic factors. So there are some sensors out there right now that we've been deploying, and they're called CFETs. And we've demonstrated there's tons of variation in the water, and that is more variable than we ever thought here around Santa Barbara in the coast of California. And this is a sensor network now that's been built in collaboration with our lab, with the NOAA Channel Islands Sanctuary folks. The National Park Service has been involved, led by one of my grad students, Lydia Kapsenberg. And we've been able to put quite a few sensors in our local Santa Barbara Channel region to try to characterize what's going on in the ocean. And these things are just an electronics setup that has a pH electrode that is programmed to take a measurement every 5 minutes, every hour, whatever you want. And what you end up with, for example, these are some of Lydia Kapsenberg's data, you end up with traces of pH change wherever you put your sensor. And these two data sets, as we look at natural variability, come from a couple places out on the Channel Islands here right in front of campus, Santa Cruz Island and Anacapa Island. And one of the things you should notice is that one of the lines is showing a higher pH than the other line. And this was really interesting to us, obviously. But it turns out that pH varies naturally all the time. You can see this cycle of pH going up and down. You see the same thing on a coral reef. And it's actually respiration and biological processes in the water that are changing it. And so whereas we started this story thinking that, oh, ocean acidification is going to wipe out everything, we've come to a place as a science community where we realize that there are areas in the ocean, especially along the coast, where we have eelgrass beds and kelp forests, these big, big macrophytes, we call them, big algae, big plants, and they do a lot of photosynthesis, so much so that they suck carbon dioxide out of the water and change the pH of the water, alkalizing it, right? So in a lot of ways, they're buffering it. And there's a lot of discussion that these things actually are sort of creating refuges from future acidification. They're really important habitats because baby fish and baby invertebrates spend a lot of time in them. And the reason it's important is because when global change biology and ocean acidification came together, the discussion was that this was a global problem, and oh man, the whole ocean was going to turn acid and we're toast, right? But actually, with the use of these sensors and more knowledge to action, we've realized that by getting more knowledge, we can understand our local areas a little bit better. And that means that we don't have to sit around and go, oh my gosh, there's nothing we can do, but we can actually start characterizing where we have these eelgrass beds. Are they inside marine protected areas? Because they're little savings, they're little investments in keeping a nice, happy pH habitat for developing invertebrates and fish. Where are they? We should map them, and that's kind of what we're doing now, because they're investments in the future, right? So we want people like the National Park and the Sanctuary as our partners as we go out and kind of look at our local area. And then when we find out that eelgrass is really good, and it is, then we can say, hey, let's protect some of this space. Let's put it in a place where we say, hey, please don't anchor your sailboat here. Don't rip up eelgrass with your anchor. Or maybe even restore eelgrass beds that have historically been there. So the balancing act, from a very big view, scientifically, right? So this kind of characterizes what I do as a scientist. This slide pretty much says it all. So we want to go out and look for natural variation in the environment. How is the environment changing? Because even though climate change is coming and ocean acidification is coming, it'll be layered on top of what's going on already, right? And we're looking for future refuges to ocean acidification because those macrophytes are buffering places. So we're out there in the environment and we're looking for those things. So we're continuing to want to collaborate to put those sensors out in the water. And then, you know, we want to deal with the organisms. We want to look for the ability to adapt, do laboratory experiments, look at different genotypes, compare populations, and do that by selecting organisms that are critical locally or ecologically, right? And then lastly, you know, you want to reach out to the people that are making decisions and show them what you've learned, show them what you know. Let them know that we have a problem or we don't. And you don't have to be biased. You just present what you know to the policymakers. And I've done this enough that I feel pretty comfortable with it, but it's kind of an area where some scientists feel that they're not objective. So that if I say, ooh, there's a lot of variation in pH over eelgrass beds, that's not a political position, that's just delivering what I know. And I don't have to be prescriptive for any law or anything that's going to happen. I'm just giving my information and sharing it with decision makers. Sometimes a politician or a manager will ask you a question like, oh, you know, can you tell me what you think about X? And then you get into this zone where you have to just be honest and say, well, to the best of my ability, this is what I think is going to happen, and do the best that you can. But I think here it's really important that as scientists, we're engaged in these things, that we just don't stay in our labs and do our experiments and publish them in a paper and talk to each other in an echo chamber, right? So we need to talk to the outside community. We need to talk to people that are making decisions about how we care for our ocean, right? So summary statement, you know, distilled down into just a couple little lines. You always want to collate your sensors with biology so that you are doing those things side by side and together so you get the best information. You want to act locally so we all don't have to fly off to Antarctica like I do. You can work right here on the coast of California and get a lot of really important information. We always want to work collaboratively, reach out to your oceanographic colleagues, to that marine zoology expert who knows copepods really well and you don't. And most importantly, don't give up, because sometimes when you're working in this field, it can feel a little bit intense, like, wow, we're really in trouble. But I think the more information we have, the better decisions we'll be able to make in terms of protecting and keeping our oceans healthy and around for generations to come. So thanks very much, and I'll take questions. Where are you?
I'm way back. Why do you think that the females don't confer an advantage on the way the fathers do?
We don't know that. I think it's probably, we're looking into it right now. It may just be some genes that are inherited from the males. But that's a really good question, because in other systems, it's really clear that the condition and what the female experiences is really important. They're going to want me to go back to the rug. It's not because the rug is so cool and comfortable. It's because they're filming me, and I walked over there to see you. I'm back, TV guys. With the urchins, it's genetic, but there are some really neat studies, for example, on fish that live in tidal marshes, where early in the season, when the pH isn't very low, and then late in the season when it's really scary acidic, the females late in the season have babies and lay these baby eggs that turn into baby fish that are better able to tolerate that low pH condition just in the span of one exposure over the summer. So that's some sort of maternal investment that the female's making to those fish, and it varies case by case. But it's a really important area of study for organismal biologists, because a lot of times somebody will publish a study and they'll make some sweeping claim, like this is how all organisms will respond. And we really need to look case by case. Ah, here we go.
In the beginning of the presentation, you mentioned four different ways that organisms react to changes in the environment. But what's the difference between assimilation and adaptation?
Acclimation and adaptation?
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay, yeah. So acclimation is just, you know, people would say, you're getting used to it. So when you go somewhere for the first time, you acclimate to it, you get used to it. And so acclimation means that if you're an organism in a particular temperature environment, if the temperature changes, you have the physiological tools, the things already in your physiology to adjust and respond and get used to that temperature change without having to migrate. Adaptation is a true microevolutionary, like change your genes kind of response. So it's a very much more difficult and not often found response. And we always hope that species do have a lot of acclimation ability, because then they don't have to migrate or become extinct.
So adaptation is a more like intense
change? Yeah, it's genetic. Okay. Change the genes. I'll tell you more. Come find me, I'll send you a paper. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Have you identified a mechanism by which some urchins are able to calcify better in low pH, or do you not know how they do it?
Great question. You know, when I started studying this about 7 or 8 years ago, I thought, wow, I'm just going to go, you know, check out the calcification biology of urchins and corals. And surprisingly, some of the really basic mechanisms of just how calcification is done isn't known, right? But with that said, do you really want the answer? This is your moment. You can escape and not get the answer. You can go, nah, I'm okay.
No, I'll take the answer.
You want it?
Answer.
Okay. So what happens in a marine invertebrate when they're making that hard part? There's this space, an extracellular space around that skeleton rod or around whatever the coral's making, and it's called an extracellular privilege space. And what seems to go on, this is the part of the mechanism that we kind of think we do know, in that little space, the conditions, the pH, the concentrations of carbonate ion are perfect because there are all these ion pumps working on the tissue around that space to move ions in and out of it. So the animal actually maintains this really special intracellular soup around the hard part that it's calcifying with and using the enzymes to do calcification. So organisms that can defend their calcification processes are somehow adjusting those ion pumps, and they're better at maintaining their intracellular soup. We don't quite know exactly sometimes what those concentrations are, because that requires just insane microelectrotechnology. But people are advancing on this by using lots of different molecular probes and dyes. But that's a really good question. And it's a great example of where you get into a global change biology zone and you think you're going to run off and figure everything out. And then when you get to the basic biology, you find out, oh, nobody knows. So it then facilitates a lot of additional research on the question.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hi.
Your work talked about individual organisms, but what I was wondering about is the relationship between organisms in the food chain. So if you've identified, you know, good pH here, low pH, or not good, but whole.
Yeah,
high,
no, it's.
But how then does that translate into organisms that need to be feeding the next higher element of the food chain?
That's a great question. So you have highlighted probably the mechanism by which we think a lot of ecosystem changes are going to happen and how these things are going to play out. And they're called species interactions. Who's eating who? What's changed in the food chain? And that's really hard to do. And some of that right now, honestly, for most ecosystems is really TBD, and I don't know if we'll ever know it. But we can infer things. So an example of something that we study in the lab here at UCSB right now are these teeny tiny little mollusks called pteropods. And I didn't bring a picture of them today, but they're these little tiny snails. I mean, they're little. They're like a pepper grain. And they occur in clouds in high latitude seas like the Arctic and the Antarctic. And fish eat them like crazy. They're very nutritious, a lot of lipid and protein. And so they're just like the little tiny power bars of the ocean, and they're chowing away at them. And in some parts of these oceans, like the Antarctic, there's a very short food chain. So the fish eat the pteropods, and the seals and the penguins all eat the fish. Now, the pteropods are calcifiers. They make that little shell, and it looks like people think who study them, us, you know, think that they're pretty vulnerable to ocean acidification. So there's an exact example where we think there's one class of organism that if it goes, or its range moves it, and chases some happy calcification environment in the ocean, then food chains start to change radically. And my last comment on that is, it's not just ecologists that care, but it's fishery biologists that care, because in Alaska, salmon eat pteropods like crazy. And so there are salmon fisheries managers who are like, wow, man, so if the pteropods shift north, or if they go somewhere else, then the salmon stocks aren't getting some of their food, and that affects the quality of the fishery. And so, not surprisingly, a lot of the fisheries labs and fisheries biologists that work for NOAA and some of the Alaska agencies actually have entire groups that are studying little pteropods to try to understand their biology better. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So how would dissolving carbon dioxide into the ocean retract from the carbonate ions already present there?
Oh, can you say that again? I smacked my mic. I'm sorry.
Okay. So like dissolving carbon dioxide into the ocean, how would it retract from the carbonate ions like already present in the ocean?
How does it detract? How does it retract?
Yeah, detract.
So how does it scavenge it? How does it do it?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to this cartoon. Am I in the right place? So what does that look like to you? Ready? So first, carbon dioxide dissolves into the water, right? And then chemically it combines with a molecule of water and forms carbonic acid. Does that look clear?
Yeah.
So I'm going to see if I'm answering what you want to know. And then that acid dissociates, so it chemically breaks apart so that you get a hydrogen ion, right? And a carbonate ion coming from that carbonic acid. And the next thing that goes on is that the carbonate ion is that really important building block, and it is chemically kind of slurped away in this reaction into carbonate ions. So it's kind of sucked up, if you will. It's not as available. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it's a chemical reaction. And there's a kind of an equilibrium in the water. And when the pH shifts, the availability of those ions just goes down. And the crazy thing is that it's this big global process, and yet it's just really simple chemistry. So there are things that you can do. If we had a glass of water with a pH indicator in it, you can... You have so much CO2 in your exhalation that you can change the pH of the surface of that water. And when that happens in seawater, there's less carbonate ion around for the organisms.
Okay, so there would just be like more bicarbonate.
Okay. That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank
yep,
you.
You bet. Hi.
Other than calcifiers with a shell, how do changes in pH affect like the clownfish I saw on there?
Yeah. Have you read that paper? No? Okay. The clownfish. That's a good question because clownfish are at the heart of one of the surprises that we have about ocean acidification. So you're right in that everyone identified calcifying things as sort of being like the ones on the chopping block. Their biology was threatened. But people started to ask, well, surely the change in the proton environment of water might influence other biological things. And one of the things that people found was that little larval fish on coral reefs, in this case, clownfish was the example. There's a guy named Phil Munday who did this in Australia. They kind of smell their natal reef, like they smell it and they track back to it behaviorally. And when the pH environment in which they're moving drops in pH, they're not as good as returning to their natal reef. So it literally changes the way they smell things. It's kind of crazy. Yeah, and so there's some folks who think it's got a lot to do with brain chemistry, that there's some neurotransmitters that those pathways might be altered. But it's not surprising, really, if you're a larval fish because there's not very much of you. And larval fish yet haven't started to osmoregulate. And so it's pretty clear that they might be interfacing with the environment more than we think. But so that's one example of how there's some surprises out there that it's just not the shell.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi. So you talked about presenting your research to politicians and decision makers.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how receptive they were to like being willing to change and like help the environment, especially considering like with global warming, there's the whole like political controversy over whether it's actually happening or not, and just like their response to your research.
Yeah. Interesting question. Do you want me to tell you the truth, or do you want me to just be like give you general examples, or do you want real information?
Real information.
Okay. I always ask. You just never know. So I think on average, all the policymakers that I've talked to and interacted with, and when we say policymaker, I'm talking about state legislatures here in California, legislators here in California, Lois Capps, you know, our representatives in California and senators in California, some people on the various science committees in Washington, D.C. So people that are not scientists, are very concerned and trying to make the right decisions, they've been very receptive to hearing about this. There's always a little bit of pushback when you're talking to people who have different political opinions. I usually get the most pushback, and I have to be the most articulate and on my game when I'm talking to people who, for example, are on the Republican Science Committee. I hate to say that, but it's true. Here's the truth. There's a lot of climate denial. There are people that, in my experience, just say they don't believe the science, and that's their opinion. And they have decided that that's how they're going to think. But the vast majority of our policymakers in the U.S. are really open to it. And last comment on that is that ocean acidification has been quite interesting because it is a CO2 issue, carbon dioxide dissolving in the ocean and changing the chemistry, but it also links directly to food security. And so you can get a lot of unity from people of different political backgrounds and different, you know, bipartisan agreement when you have ocean acidification about to wipe out oyster farming in Washington State and harm salmon fisheries in Alaska. People very quickly sit up and care and pay attention to what's going to happen for their constituents. And so it's been good. I've only had a good experience. You're welcome. Are you going to do that? Is that something you want to do? Yeah. Maybe. Oh, over here. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
So, are the changes in the pH levels in the ocean affecting the coast of California in agriculture, like the soil?
So, does the pH variation in the ocean affect land stuff? It's very scientific land stuff. So, you know, interesting. I don't know that we really know that. I think most of what we study is the other way around, that stuff, input from the land, like pollution in rivers and stuff that's coming, nutrients like sewage that's coming from the land or from a river and estuary that goes out into the ocean, that interacts with the pH environment. And one of the things that we think is that ocean acidification and oxygen content are going to change together in a way that's probably really important for us to understand because it influences everything from how well larval fish do to big algae blooms in the water. But I don't know if anybody's really looked at how pH in the ocean influences the land. Like, does it erode it more, do you think, or... does it go up rivers and affect the land around it? Yeah?
That's my question.
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think that there's that much evidence of that. It's usually the other way around. Stuff coming from the land influencing the ocean.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. That wasn't a very good answer, but there it is.
So regarding upwelling.
Yes.
So in environmental science class, we learned that it's usually a beneficial phenomenon because of the nutrient-rich waters.
Yes.
But now that there's more dissolved carbonate or dissolved acid in the water, has it started to become a problem?
It's a very tuned-up question you have there. So the thing is, so I learned this from a guy named Richard Feely, who's an oceanographer at NOAA, and he's just super cool and pretty much was the one who helped me learn all this. So when that upwelling happens, the wind blows across the ocean and it actually just turns the ocean so that water from the deep comes up to the surface. And you're right. People would say, oh, that's good. Here come all these nutrients. And it was really good to fertilize those parts of the ocean. And you'd end up with upwelling zones being what people, biological oceanographers would call really productive. So lots of food, lots of zooplankton, and then the fish eat the zooplankton and it's a really happy place, right? Well, when people started to be able to measure pH of that water, they found out that, in fact, it was really acidic. And then people like Richard Feely and other oceanographers and modelers said, you know, that CO2 deep in the ocean, they have ways that can measure this. It's like, that's about 50 years old. So then you connect the dots so that as CO2 in the atmosphere goes up and we store more carbon dioxide in the deep ocean, every year more CO2 is coming up, is what people are thinking. So in terms of upwelling now becoming a cause for concern, it's called the California Coastal Ecosystem, or the CCS, California Current System, here on our coast. It could be that upwelling becomes stressful because that water is going to become ever more acidic. So that's the scary new reality of people on the coast thinking about upwelling. And there's this guy named Nicholas Gruber who's written some really neat papers about it. And by neat, I mean scary, because he's done some modeling that says in 50 years, upwelling events on the coast of California will be just super acidic. And it's going to be bad for everybody. So we'll wait and see if that happens. Thank you for that question. Yeah.
Hi. So, I was just wondering how you... What?
I just pointed at you.
Oh.
Go!
Okay. I was just wondering how you can measure whether or not adaptation happens. Like, doesn't it take a long time? And even if you can see some changes, physical changes, how do you know for sure?
No, that's a great question. In fact, it's like the hardest part about this. So, do you know evolutionary biology? Do you know it?
I know whatever they taught me in high school.
Yay! Okay, that's good. Then the answer is yes. So how do you get... What does selection act on? What do you need to have evolution happen?
There has to be a change, like when an organism reproduces, there has to be like a mutation that benefits the environment.
Exactly. So you got to have a mutation. So that's number one. The other one is kind of hard. You might not remember it. But you have to have enough standing genetic stock in your population for selection to act on it. So you have to have a lot of variability. And so... the way people study this is usually looking at this process, because you could sit around forever and looking for a mutation that would give you a response to an environmental condition, right? That is not a great way to study biology, and it just takes forever. So what people do in practice is they go in and they take a population and they use all these different techniques in genetics to ask, what's the standing, how much genetic diversity is in there, and what traits does that diversity code for that would allow one to adapt to the environment? So this whole field has been, you know, around for a really long time, and it's especially been practiced in plant biology, but it's been really laborious. You had to do crosses and common garden environments to figure out, well, here's this genotype that maybe was really hard to get that does well in, let's say, salty soil. Now, we've really been aided by some new technology called next-generation sequencing, where you can go in and sequence a genome, and you can look at genes and see polymorphisms. And you can form hypotheses that those polymorphisms are enough to do something different in that gene. So it's a huge, huge field right now, comparative genomics, evolutionary genomics, all driven by technology. So you can do it.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, let's thank Dr. Gretchen Hoffman.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.